I'd like to read you a poem. It was written by Denise Levertov. A friend of mine copied it out and gave it to me for Valentine's Day one year, and I keep it framed in my studio. It's called The Secret. Two girls discover the secret of life in a sudden line of poetry. I, who don't know the secret, wrote the line. They told me, through a third person, they had found it, but not what it was, not even what line it was. No doubt by now, more than a week later, they have forgotten the secret, the line, the name of the poem. I love them for finding what I can't find, and for loving me for the line I wrote, and for forgetting it, so that 1,000 times, till death finds them, they may discover it again in other lines, in other happenings, and for wanting to know it, for assuming there is such a secret. Yes, for that most of all. In Michigan, where I live, there's a mushroom called a morel that pops up through the earth for a few unpredictable weeks in the spring, sometime after the snow has turned to rain and the sun has started to warm up the soil. It's a delicacy. All of the local restaurants have ads in the newspaper offering to buy morels, and they feature dishes made with them. It's a democratic delicacy because they're free if you can learn how to find them. Even people who don't especially like to eat morels like to hunt for them. When you see a car parked on the side of the road in the springtime with nothing nearby but a tree-covered hill, you know that the driver of the car is in those woods looking for morels. People have secret spots they return to every year, and while they may be only too happy to hand you a grocery bag filled with morels, they will never tell you where they found them. There's an art to finding morels, which are brown and wrinkled and blend in with the rippled bark and the fallen twigs and the dried-up leaves and the mottled lumps of dirt. They're nearly impossible to see, until you see them. There are people who say they can find them anywhere, and other people, including me, who almost never find them. It's an art most often described in mystical terms. You look for them by not looking for them. You have to unfocus your eyes. Even resolute Polish Catholics become Zen masters when it's time to hunt mushrooms in Michigan. It reminds me, in a way, of the line from Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood about Bessie Bighead watching for Gomer Owen, who kissed her once by the pigsty when she wasn't looking and never kissed her again, although she was looking all the time. I think the secret of life does that. It hides brown and wrinkled among the dead leaves and broken twigs and the lumps of dirt. It kisses you when you aren't looking. Okay, not always. Sometimes it hits you over the head with a baseball bat. But I think a lot of us, most of us maybe, are looking, even if we're looking by not looking. Looking all the time, believing there is such a thing. We come across little pieces of it. All 6.5 billion of us blind men coming across gray and wrinkled pieces of the elephant in the room that is life, that is the world. When we arrive in the world as babies, we come into such very particular situations, which can be so very different from one another. But we don't know how particular our situations are because we don't have anything to compare them to. Our world is the whole world, it's all that we know. We're pretty busy just figuring out how it all works and how we fit into it. What pleasures are there for us, what we will try to steer clear of. For a long time, our world grows larger as our parents or whoever is standing in for them allow it to. We depend on them to help us understand it. But all along, bit by bit, we begin to meet the world that is beyond our parents' explanations. We encounter something that contradicts what we've been taught or was overlooked. We begin to try to understand the world for ourselves, and we begin to be aware that we have our own ideas that are in some ways separate and different from the ideas of those around us. The extreme example of this, of course, is if you are one of those children raised by wolves, but it happens to most of us, I think. We realize that the world is larger than anyone told us. We find out that our parents are human beings with strengths and limitations, that they don't know everything. Some of them are aware of this even before we tell them. Others are harder to convince. Either way, we head out on the road that is our own life in the world. So what is it like out there? It's scary and exciting, lonely and crowded, noisy, boring sometimes. It's heart-stoppingly beautiful, with unexplainable ugliness. There is kindness, cruelty, and indifference. There is serendipity, and there is being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I could go on. It's a lot to try to make sense out of, and often the tools we have seem so inadequate. If we're lucky, we might find at times that someone is walking along next to us and they say, "You're not crazy, I see it too." Or they say, "Did you ever notice how?" and for a moment, the discombobulated mechanics of the world organize themselves according to some principle we hadn't perceived before, and we see that even we are a part of it. We are connected. We pocket these moments and string them up like beads on a rosary, like clues to a mystery. They are gifts given freely to us by our fellow travelers, and they come in many forms. A conversation, a meeting of glances, an embrace, a song on the radio, a story. Stories entered my life early on. Stories that were told on the porch or at the kitchen table. I heard the events of our life reshaped creatively to make them more interesting or to support a point of view. In what for a long time seemed to be a completely unrelated development, reading also entered my life early on. My sister Kathy taught me to read when I was 4 and she was 6. She had learned to sound out words and she showed me how to do it too. I don't remember this myself, it's one of the stories I heard. I do remember finding both the drawings and the poetry of Go Dog Go to be deeply compelling. The stories and the reading seemed separate because the stories were so social while reading was, on the surface, a solitary pleasure. My parents read newspapers and magazines, only occasionally books. I think my attraction to reading books was seen as a harmless eccentricity, good in the sense that it was related to doing well in school. I was largely unguided, free to float down the stream of whatever reading materials came my way. I read TV Guide and Little House on the Prairie and the Childcraft Encyclopedia with equal involvement. I also watched TV and movies and listened to music and rode my bike and had friends and stayed awake all night at sleepovers. Our family went on vacations to the seashore, but books had a special place, an important place. I don't think I could have said why. In junior high, when I went to the bookmobile, I would pick out the thickest books I could find. If they had small, dense type and a lot of unfamiliar words, all the better. I can still picture my copy of David Copperfield. This is because I still have it. I'm sure a lot of what I read went over my head. When I read these books now, I can hardly believe they're the same books I read then. When I think about junior high, I think about it as the time when the rules I had been taught no longer seemed to apply. There was a new social order, and I didn't like it, or my place in it. I felt suddenly insufficient, and the advice I received on this topic, while given with love and the intent to be comforting, did not often seem to help me to find a satisfying way to be in the world I actually lived in. This, of course, was something I had to learn for myself over a long period of time. Books, though, acknowledged that life was complex. They offered up the possibility that other things besides this could happen. And I think now that though I didn't fully understand it at the time, they showed me that whatever you encounter, if you can meet it with honesty, intelligence, compassion, and humor, on some level, you win. To tell the truth in an interesting way, a way that allows for real sorrow, a way that allows for real laughter, is to open a door where there only seemed to be a wall. This is the opposite of spin, which only paints a picture of a door and hangs it on the wall in a gilded frame. I was looking for doors. Sometimes I found them. They appeared in different forms. A conversation with my dad, a song on the radio, a feeling of familiarity with someone I had only just met, a story that offered possibility, the secret of life in a sudden line of poetry. I remember being smitten with the novels of Kurt Vonnegut with sentences like, "Her smile was glassy and she was ransacking her mind for something to say, finding nothing in it but used Kleenex and costume jewelry," or, "Her face was one of a kind, a surprising variation on a familiar theme, a variation that made observers think, yes, that would be another nice way for people to look." I remember being struck by these sentences, these thoughts, these stories about the imaginary island of San Lorenzo and one of the moons of the planet Saturn, and feeling that they had something to do with my life, the life I was actually living in. All of these ideas, songs, stories, gifts from fellow travelers helped me to find the world that is larger than, but also contained in, the specific little town where I grew up. In fairy tales, it is the brother who shares the crust of bread his mother has packed for him, however poor and hard it is, who finds that the mysterious beggar is really a powerful wizard who can help him. No such good comes to the brothers who keep their lunches all to themselves, but if you share what you have, the roles of giver and receiver reverse themselves, like alternating current. There is a connection, an electricity. Writing and drawing are two of the ways I respond to the world. There are so many ways, so many wonderful ways, but words and pictures have always been important to me, so that's what I do. A lot of what I write and draw We'll never see the light of day, and that's fine, it's as it should be. But as I go along, I find that there are stories and pictures and ideas I want to share. And so, at the risk of adding one more metaphor to this whole heap of them that's about to topple over, I put the crust of bread I have to share into a bottle called a book and toss it into the ocean. Actually, since I live in the Midwest, I have to send it to Virginia Duncan in New York City, who tosses it into the ocean for me. And then I steel myself for the very real possibility that it will get lost out there. It's a big ocean, I say to myself, and such a little bottle. The important thing, I say, is to do it whether anyone sees it or not. But writers write because they want to connect. The agenda of a writer is simple. It is, I want to tell you something. Maybe it's a joke, maybe a story, maybe the secret of life, or all three. So try as I might to pretend it doesn't matter, I toss out my bottle with the hope that it will be found, and even more that the someone who finds it will care about it. I've thought to myself sometimes, how many people do you need to find it and care about it? And the answer I've come up with when I'm at my times of lowest expectations is 5 or 6. I've thought, if you really, really connect with 5 or 6 people, what more can you want? And then, in January of this year, I got kissed when I wasn't looking. In one short phone call, I learned that my 5-person quota had been exceeded by 200% to 15 people, and not just any 15 people, but 15 librarians, who in my experience are among the top 1% of humans on the earth in terms of being smart, funny, thoughtful, principled people. That would have been enough. But what this phone call also meant was that in a very concrete way, I get to be a fellow traveler. I get to share my crust of bread. I get to say to someone who may be feeling as out of sorts as I did, as I still sometimes do, it's okay, you're not crazy, I see it too. But have you ever noticed? It takes 2 people to make a book, a writer and a reader, and it's not clear-cut or constant who is doing the giving and who is receiving. The roles of giver and receiver go back and forth like alternating current when there's a connection. I'd like to thank the American Library Association, the ALSC, and Barbara Barstow and the Newbery Committee from the bottom of my heart for giving me this immense opportunity to make that connection. And because what I just said about it taking 2 people to make a book was a patent understatement of the truth, and in reality it takes a whole village to make a book, I also thank Virginia Duncan, my editor, Sylvie LaFleur for making my book beautiful, and every wonderful person at Greenwillow Books and HarperCollins Children's Books. I thank Bill and Lucy and Frank. And I thank those of every persuasion, from Polish Catholic to Zen Master, who have shown me doors when I couldn't see them. Thank you all.